now with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Hauck.
Hello, hello, everybody. Welcome to Friday. Here we are again. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity. Good afternoon to one and all. It is 3 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Standard Time, anywhere time in between, or maybe you're catching this show on one of the podcasts. So thank you for that. I am Dr. James Hauck, and if you'd like more information about me or to leave me your comments about today's broadcast, I just invite you to visit the website. It's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity, all one word there. So www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And as I had mentioned, these broadcasts are podcasted. So in case you want to go back and listen again, or if you want to go back into the archives and listen to previous shows, again, you can find that information all on the website. And as I've been doing, you know, in this second year of these broadcasts, I just wanted to thank everybody for their support over the past year, and glad to be part doing this continuously in the second year. And would just like to say that you now have an opportunity to continue your support by becoming a monthly subscriber. Now, I just want to clear the air a little bit that subscription is not required to listen to these shows, but it is greatly appreciated. So again, you go to the website and click on the link and choose any amount that you feel comfortable giving. Well, I'm very happy to be with you here today. Like I said, every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and anywhere else. Each and every week, these broadcasts are dedicated to the integration of spirituality and our mental health. And if you would like to call in to be part of the broadcast, part of the show, invite you to dial in. That number is 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. Okay, and I'll be taking your calls after the break in the second half of the show. So for those of you who are tuning in for the very first time, I just wanted to say welcome. I'm always excited to have new listeners. And just in case you're wondering what Reclaiming Authenticity is all about, it's basically this, that Reclaiming Authenticity focuses on the integration of spirituality and our mental health, all within the context of our relationships, the relationship that we have with ourselves, the relationships that we have with others, and the relationship that we have with God or the divine. And for those of you who are tuning in for the very first time, just want to share with you just two deep-seated beliefs that, you know, pretty much my philosophy of my outlook on life and how and why I work with people the way that I do. I am a clinical mental health therapist in Pennsylvania, but I do a lot of telemental health and a long history of being a counseling educator, clinical supervisor, and so forth, as well as just a deep interest in spiritual matters, religious matters, and spent many years working with people in various, let's say, religious denominations, various congregations in different capacities, and so forth. So, but I'll share with you that I am definitely a firm believer that all of us come into this world from the time that we're born, and even then some, you know, way before we are born, way before we incarnate, with everything that we already need. You know, we come into this world already equipped and graced with everything that we need in this life in terms of, you know, our gifts, our skills, our talents, our strengths, our character traits, and so forth. And yet, as we go along in life, and maybe we run into some unpleasant experiences just because we're human, or we're in the wrong place at the wrong time, and we suffer something very traumatic, we may tend to stop trying to discover our giftedness, or stop looking for our strengths or our talents, or maybe we push those skills way down so that others cannot see it, because perhaps we were told that we would never amount to anything when we were in school, or perhaps there was a time in our life where we really was just shining with our gifts and our talents, and we were ridiculed for it. Or we were persecuted for it, whatever the situation is. But we started listening to the voices outside of ourselves that were basically telling us that there's nothing special to us. And when we start listening to those voices, we don't realize our giftedness and our strengths. And we often go through life functioning from a place of woundedness or a place of victimization, instead of a place of healing and wholeness and embracing our hachetas, or our uniqueness, okay? And that uniqueness was something that reminds me. I was having a great conversation with a youngster last week, and of course, he's getting ready for back to school, because here we are in mid-August already, and he was struggling to find his shine, S-H-I-N-E, because he was very gifted at sports, still is, but he's also going through a time of being bullied. And so it was just, something that he had lost his shine, according to his parents. And so I said to him, let's go find your shine, because when you shine, you're probably the happiest that you've ever been. And he agreed with that. So he and I are working on going back and finding that sparkle, that shine, in which he can be his old self and pretty much not listen to the bullies, not being intimidated by that. Okay. And this is why I place, reclaiming authenticity and this integration of spirituality and mental health all in the context of relationships. Because when we think about it, it's kind of ironic that, with us being social creatures, we often receive our deepest physical, emotional, psychological, even spiritual wounds in and through relationships. And yet, and here's the irony, we can also discover our greatest healing, strength, peace, forgiveness, and love through healthier relationships. And these relationships, we don't have to go too far to find them, because they just might be within our own families, or they just might be our coworkers and colleagues. They just might be amongst our friends. Okay. Because whenever we transform, or in the process of being transformed or transforming, we also transform others by our presence, our grace, and our understanding. And this was something that I was constantly getting across to my students. It's like, never underestimate the power of presence. The power of presence, your presence, my presence, your presence speaks volumes even before we open our mouths. Okay, it's just how we are with people, how we look at them, how we smile or we don't smile, and so forth. Okay. But a lot of the times we have to begin the work in ourselves. So think about it this way. Whenever we transform, we also transform others by our presence, that grace and understanding. But as I said, we have to work on ourselves first, and especially in the areas of forgiveness, gratitude, and love, and kindness and compassion. It does always begin with how we treat ourselves, because whenever we're compassionate with ourselves, we can certainly be more compassionate with others. And when we are more forgiving with ourselves, we then can be more forgiving with others. And when we're able to live in gratitude with ourselves, we then discover how this really opens up our hearts to see and live in gratitude with others, because transformation actually begins with us. Well, how is your heart today? How is your transformation going? I hope it is well. I hope you are well. And I pray that if you are struggling today, that you'll be able to find the rest, the comfort, and the peace that you need. Well, just want to thank you again for being here today. This is going to be a little difficult topic to broach. All last month, and I'm carrying it through this month, we're taking a look at how do we transform the energies, or, you know, how do we transform the dimensional energies, I should say, of intergenerational trauma. You know, first of all, what is intergenerational trauma, and how do we get out from under it? Okay. And as I shared last week, that, we begin the process by being able to tell our stories. And there's a famous quote from Robert Sutton, who basically said, "When you dismiss my story, you dismiss who I am, because you diminish me. When you dismiss my story, you dismiss who I am. You diminish me." And so everybody's story is important. Everybody has a right to be heard. And today's topic is certainly one of those topics in which many people have tried to be silenced. But interestingly enough, if you've been listening to me for some time now, you know that I am a strong believer that the dead talk. The dead have different ways of talking to us and speaking to us. And, you know, people who want to quiet the soul, so to speak, can never do that, because the soul can never be silenced. So today's topic is the doctrine of discovery. How do we get here, and where do we go from here? Well, the doctrine of discovery is something that's been around a long, long time, centuries and centuries and centuries. However, I never learned this in school. I didn't even hear anything about it until I was, into my 30s, when I started to do my own research with, trauma and loss and grief and intergenerational trauma. Then, the doctrine of discovery was kind of all over the place, but it was kind of hidden in plain sight. Okay. And for those of you who are not familiar with the term, the doctrine of discovery, it is basically, had a great emphasis in the time of, colonization, and even then some. And it was all due to its dependence on a collaboration. And back in those days, a collaboration of the church and state that actually cemented the fate of indigenous people. And again, here is the irony that's going on in the doctrine of discovery. It's that, the papacy, the popes, gave their blessing and anointed such rulers and representatives as, as they called it, sanctified conquerors. And they were basically commissioned to go in the name of God to confiscate and control other lands of anything they discovered not already claimed by Christian rulers. In other words, the ruling church of the day, the Catholic Church, treated indigenous people as if they were animals. They had no European title to the land on which they lived. And for example, 40 years before Columbus, went out and sailed the ocean blue, it was Pope Nicholas V who issued to King Alfonso V of Portugal the Bull Romanus Pontificax, or the Doctrine of Discovery, 40 years before Columbus. Okay, so this doctrine, specifically sanctioned war on all non-Christian people and gave explorers such as Columbus and Cortez and Pizarro and Cook and Hudson and all the others both legal and moral license to do whatever they wanted to people and the lands that they encountered. And these explorers not only carried, the papal authority to conquer, colonize, and exploit all non-Christian lands, but they also, were given the authority to capture and vanquish and subdue people of the Muslim faith or pagans or any other so-called enemies of Christ, and take all their possessions and property. And this papal bull was often viewed as an extension of this socio-political, theological stance of the Crusades. You know, medieval centuries of the military campaigns designed to expand the territory of Christendom. And it was across Europe and Africa and the Middle East. And although these Crusades stretched from the 11th to somewhere around the 15th centuries, they really had no shortage of Crusader volunteers who were pretty much absolved of their sins, you know, all the while killing in the name of God those who did not follow Christianity. Okay, and again, I'm not making any of this up. It is widely known out there if you know where to look. But again, this isn't something that's taught in schools. So let's fast forward 40 years. And so by the time Columbus sailed in 1492, he was authorized to take possession of any lands he discovered that were not under the dominion of any Christian rulers. And again, furthermore, in 1493, a year after this, Pope Alexander issued what was called the Inter Cetera, which granted Spain's Catholic king and queen, you remember Ferdinand and Isabella, the right to conquer lands which Columbus had already found, as well as any lands which Spain might discover in the future, including any people discovered in such lands that were to be subjugated and brought to the faith itself. So a lot of mass coercion going on here. And again, it was just done in the name of the church, in the name of God. And this act basically ensured the Christian empire would continue to span through the you know, pretty much just the basic acts of the brutal acts of genocide committed by Columbus and his men against the indigenous people of the Caribbean, okay? And this is something that comes up every year whenever Columbus Day is going to be celebrated. There's huge protests and, you know, it's just hotly debated on both sides. But this, again, isn't something that's taught so much in school, but is, again, it's widely known and, you can find it if you know where to look. Okay, so again, it's, you know, how history has been taught and what is being taught, as well as the refusal to change what has been taught or what is being taught. And we'll get to that a little bit later on here, you know, because these doctrines, the doctrine of discovery and the Inter Cetera, you know, have yet to be repealed by the Catholic Church. Okay, so these papal documents, you know, were frequently used by European conquerors in the Americas to justify an incredibly brutal system of colonization, which dehumanized the indigenous people by regarding their territories as being inhabited only by brute animals. And that's a direct quote from the author's story back in 1833. Now, in 1993, okay, the Indigenous Law Institute spearheaded a movement to revoke the Inter Cetera, and over 60 Indigenous delegates drafted this Declaration of Vision at the Parliament of the World Religions in 1994. And this is what they wrote. "We call upon the people of conscience in the Roman Catholic hierarchy to persuade Pope John II to formally revoke the Inter Cetera Bull of May 4th, 1493, which will restore our fundamental human rights. The papal document called for our nations and peoples to be subjugated so the Christian Empire and its doctrines would be propagated. And the U.S. Supreme Court ruling of Johnson versus McIntosh in a document there in 1823, adopted this same principle of subjugation expressed in this Inter Cetera Bull. And this papal bull has been, excuse me, and continues to be devastating to our religions, our culture, and the survival of our populations. Now, the U.S. courts, you know, use this doctrine of discovery as late as 1970 to adjudicate issues relating to Native American tribes. And, you know, not only was, you know, letters written and requests made to Pope John II, but the requests continued. Requests were made to Pope Benedict and then to Pope Francis to rescind this doctrine, but nothing to this day has been done. Okay. And many other petitions and open letters have been written. And here's just another example of one of these letters. It says, "Your Holiness, this position as expressed in the papal bull has led Your Holiness. This position as expressed has led to several ills in this world, namely slavery, unjust treatment, poverty, discrimination, apartheid, separate but equal laws, Jim Crow, financial ruin, massacres, and much more. To justify the cruelty of slavery and the subjugation of Africans, the slaveholders, for one, claimed that Africans were not human and therefore could be used and abused any way the slaveholders so desired. This cruelty was for, as you know, the financial gain of slaveholders at the expense of others, and the slaveholders' very own humanity. Many of the slaveholders also claimed to be Christian and obviously chose to accept the ongoing concepts of the major doctrines, such as the papal bull of 1493, as a rationale for their behavior. As mentioned, people of color throughout the world still suffer from these ills. And historically, in the 20th and 21st centuries alone, all of this has been importantly coupled with countless reactions to this oppressions, such as sit-ins, marches, Occupy movements, and many other collective actions in the United States and internationally. You see, people who are aware of their intergenerational trauma often struggle to not only fight against being defined by these characteristics, but also find their struggle is against larger systems, educational, judicial, socioeconomic, correctional, and healthcare systems. And among Indigenous people, you know, there is excessive poverty and teenage suicides that exceed other ethnic peoples, and extreme incidences of type 2 diabetes and high unemployment rates and so forth. And these are just, you know, but a few examples of the contemporary cultural, communal, and individual damages experienced by Indigenous peoples in the United States. And it's due to this generational impact resulting from the legacy of this doctrine of discovery. So, yeah, we can talk about, you know, where do we go from here? We can talk about the pain that people have suffered, and rightly so. But until we recognize the self-inflicted wounds, until we recognize and take responsibility for what is still being perpetuated and still having such papal documents on the books, is just turning a blind eye to everything. Nothing is really changing. But you know, America was not the only place where the historical doctrine of discovery was felt. It also had and still has a huge impact in Australia. Okay, and for example, and it was like 1838, I believe, with a sense of entitlement to the resources of the land, the British settlers were taking more and more of the Aboriginal lands of colonial Australia. And because these settlers, feared being outnumbered by Aboriginal tribes, it was common practice then to dispose of Aboriginal people as they saw fit. And they had these gangs of stockmen, you know, namely what they called the Big Bushwhack, were known for specifically hunting Aboriginal families and raping Aboriginal women. And there was one such place called the Mile Creek Station MYALL, or it's, maybe it's just pronounced Mall, Creek Station, where these stockmen herded, you know, Aboriginal people from their huts and had their hands tied together and about, you know, 80 meters towards the top of a hill. And once they reached the top, you know, people were killed, they were beheaded, and their bodies were left to rot. And it was also reported that two young girls were spared during this, you know, Mall Creek massacre, so they would be raped later. And afterwards, it was told that the stockmen spent the night drinking and bragging about their killings. They were not shy about this at all. But after the Mall Creek massacre, attacks on Aboriginal people increased, but it became more discreet as the British continued to poison food and bury the corpses of the Aborigines. And in her work, a book entitled Massacres to Mining, The Colonization of Aboriginal Australia, author Roberts, 2008, described a little girl's account of violence toward Aboriginal people. And she quotes this little girl in this book, and this little girl's story is sobering and gut-wrenching, to say the least. And she said that my mother would sit and cry and tell me stories of how they buried our babies in the ground with their heads just above the ground. And they were all in a row, and, you know, these stockmen had tests to see who they could, you know, kill. And, you know, they would try, you know, then and spend the rest of the day just going through and ransacking places and raping women, and just, you know, stabbings and tortures and everything else. And, you know, again, a lot of mutilation, just horrific, horrific things that this little girl was told by her mother, who had witnessed this, but it stayed with this little girl. And to add further insult to injury, the Aboriginal Protection Act of 1886, it also empowered several Australian state-run institutions. Okay, it was like the Aboriginal Protection Board, with the help of local law enforcement and the British educational and religious systems. Well, this these state-run institutions forced Aboriginal people of mixed descent, known as half-castes, to assimilate into British society. Now, to achieve this assimilation, the board did not implement a system to punish, the British for any future crimes against the Aboriginal people. But instead, the state-run institutions took even more control away from the Aboriginal people, namely their identity, their family life, and culture. Because this new policy specifically targeted the removal of half-caste, that is, one white and one Aboriginal parent, the removal of half-caste children from their mothers and placing them in state and religious-run boarding schools. And it was assumed by the board that because of the increase of white settlers in the country and the increase of half-caste children, the full-blood tribal Aboriginal population would be unable to sustain itself. Okay, so if you've ever seen the movie Rabbit Proof Fence, I think that came out in 2002, it also tells a true story concerning three half-caste Aboriginal girls. Like, one was 14, one was 8, and one was 10. And they were forcibly taken from their mothers by a local constable and placed in the Moore River Native Settlement, which was located, I think, in northern Perth, Western Australia. And yet, only two of the girls escaped, and they walked a little over 1,500 miles along this rabbit-proof fence, the name of the movie, to get back home. And the movie underscores the traumatic physical, psychological, and spiritual effects the Aboriginal Protection Act had on Aboriginal families at that time. OK, Okay, and the underlying theme of this movie actually came from the chief protector, as he was called, Neville. And it's evident throughout the movie that the half-caste state of children was, in a sense, looked at as had to be bred out of them, because the Aboriginal people of Australia were a danger to themselves. Okay, and there were just other forms of so-called justifications of violence and aggression against Aboriginal people. And so by placing, you know, half-caste girls in the boarding school-like camps, they would eventually grow up to be laborers and servants to the white families in society. And if they should marry, it would only be to white men, and then the Aboriginal bloodline would diminish within a generation or two. And this was nothing new. This was standard practice in how do you get rid of certain generations. You know, it's genocide. Okay, and this was something that we just can't sit and shake our heads and say, well, that was Australia. Uh-uh. It went on here as well with the sterilization laws, you know, throughout the United States. And, you know, quite shockingly enough, Aboriginal children were still being forcibly removed from their families throughout Australia right up until about 1970. And many people still refer to these children as the stolen generation. Well, folks, you haven't heard anything yet, but I would really love to hear what's on your heart about this subject. So, again, if you want to call in, that number is 888-627-6008, and I'll be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I'm your host, Dr. James Houck, and I'll be back with you in 1 minute. Okay, welcome back. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Again, I just want to mention a word about next week's show. Tune in next Friday afternoon, 3 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, when I'm going to continue this conversation on transforming dimensional energy of intergenerational trauma as we look at the theme, You're Not Lazy, Crazy, or Stupid, the Psychological, Spiritual, Physiological Effects of Trauma. Okay, so again, we're going to continue with the question, how do we raise the vibrational energy of, shall we say, the lower dimensional atrocities and pervasive attitudes that still exist today to the higher levels of dimension where forgiveness, gratitude, and love are meant to be embraced and lived out on a daily basis? Okay. Well, earlier in the show, I was talking about the historical effects of the Doctrine of Discovery. It was a papal document that gave their blessing and anointing to the rulers and representatives, as they called sanctified conquerors, holy conquerors, to confiscate and control the lands of anything they discovered not already claimed by Christian rulers. In other words, if they set foot in it, they stuck a flag in the ground, it was theirs, or so they thought. In other words, the Catholic Church, very guilty of treating indigenous people as if they were animals, because they had no like European title, as they described it, to the land on which they lived. And again, I had explained that 40 years before Columbus had set sail, it was Pope Nicholas V, and he issued King Alfonso V of Portugal this bull, the Romanus Pontificax, the Doctrine of Discovery. And this doctrine specifically sanctioned war on all non-Christian people and gave explorers such as Columbus and Cortez and Pizarro and Cook and Hudson and all the other explorers that came after them both legal and moral license to do whatever they wanted to do to people and the lands that they encountered. And this fundamental belief that is used to justify the mistreatment of humanity is what Kevin Annett, founder of the International Tribunal into Crimes of Church and State, he describes as that when God is on our side, we can commit any crime. We are absolved individually from that crime by believing we have a higher sanction. And that's the danger of any religion. It allows people to do that. Okay? So when God is on our side, we feel like we can commit any crime, and we are absolved individually from that crime by believing that we have a higher sanction. And that's the danger of religion. It allows people to do that. Okay? And so this was exactly what was going on in the doctrine of discovery. Now, in the mental health and field and other pastoral professions, people who experience something stressful or traumatic, even intergenerational trauma, are always encouraged to talk about it. We often hear that expression, let it out or talk about it or you'll feel better, as we try to make sense of what has happened to us or what people try to make sense of what happened to them. And yet, depending on the severity of the experience, we may have difficulty. Other people may have difficulty, being able to put into words or actions what has happened. Because, granted, they still may be in shock over the traumatic experience. So talking about a situation may still take some time. If you had ever seen the movie Captain Phillips, the Tom Hanks one where he was, they made a movie with the Somalia pirates, and the final scene, hope I'm not giving anything away, so spoiler alert, the final scene where he is rescued, Tom Hanks's character is rescued, and very, very traumatic. He did a great job in studying just how trauma locks up the language in us, where we are in shock and trauma, and he was on a Red Cross ship, and he was safe and everything, and the nurse who was taking care of him and getting him cleaned up and checking his lacerations and so forth, she was just firing one question after another to Tom Hanks's character, and he was trying to answer her as best he could, and he was just like and just he was all over the place. So he did a tremendous job just studying just the psychological effects trauma has and immediate trauma has on a person in terms of shock and not being able to put that into words. And this is something that trauma can stay locked inside of us, and we just, because the region of the brain that processes language is nowhere close to the region of the brain in which the trauma has landed. And so it takes time for our brains to be able to process it and to talk about it. But that's something we're going to take a look at next week. So people are, should never be labeled as lazy, crazy, or stupid because of what they have gone through, because maybe on some level or some degree, they're still unable to talk about it. But yet the effects of the trauma is still evident in their limited perceptions or, being unable to control their addictions or other behavioral aspects to it. Okay, so again, that's next week. But, but there will come a time when hopefully, you know, the bewilderment lifts, you know, but we still might lack the words to make sense out of our traumatic pain. Okay. And, you know, although our minds may be capable of replaying the experience over and over, it's through the communicating what has happened to us through our stories and symbols and song that creates healing. And it creates, actually creates a healing context for all generations. And this is why storytelling is so important. You know, it's not just reading about the stories, but it's hearing these stories. It's allowing people to tell their stories because it creates such a powerful psycho-spiritual shift in us. You know, that psycho-spiritual emotional shift in us to be able to tell our stories, because nobody can tell our stories the way we can. And this is part of, you know, what the brain needs to do to be able to process, and the heart needs to be able to process. And this is how people find tremendous healing through traumatic experiences, especially intergenerational trauma. Now, there are sites all over the world, where we have memorial place cards or placards and or statues that are often erected to constantly remind people of the loss that was experienced in a community. And although they're well-intended to, let's never forget, these reminders often make moving beyond the traumatic event almost impossible for some people, especially when annual observances often stir up feelings of pain and unresolved grief and feelings of helplessness with no way to offer healing. You know, it's kind of like shaking up a snow globe. I know it's still summer, but go with me on this. You're shaking up a snow globe, and you know, it's pretty cool to watch the whatever it is, glitter, or, you know, the shiny stuff come down like it is snow, and it starts to land, and just eventually all the little pieces fall to the ground. But, you know, you're shaking up a snow globe and everything is just flying all over the place with no end in sight. Well, that's how people feel when, you know, during, you know, say like an annual reminder of, you know, again, well-intended, let's never forget what happened here. But people are often pulled back into a sense of being re-traumatized all over again, or wounded all over again, or, you know, just... again, extra layers are added to their unresolved grief and feelings of helplessness. And they feel like they're being victimized all over again. But instead of empowering people to transcend this energy of emotional and psychological wounds, trauma has the danger of inadvertently being passed on to succeeding generations. And the generations may take on, you know, such trauma vicariously because of their indirect involvement through community associations or blood ties or other affiliations as integrated systems. And there was an interesting study done. It was through an anthropologist, Marita Blanco. She developed an unpublished intergenerational diagram that accounts for the effects of colonization violence on subsequent generations in South Africa. And in the book with by Levine and Klein back in 2006, they noted that Marita Blanco's diagram can be traced directly to the history of Indigenous Australia. And like I said, she went through up to, I think, five generations. So she wrote, and her diagram, I should say, includes, here's what happens to the first generation. You know, say the men who were killed or imprisoned, enslaved in some way, were unable to provide for their families. Okay, that's the first generation. These are the people who experienced this atrocity. The second generation, she writes, you know, the majority of men abused alcohol and/or drugs to cope with their loss of identity and a diminished sense of self-worth. Okay. And what made matters worse was that the Queensland government passed the Aborigines Protection of Alcohol and Opium Act in 1897. And this act removed abusers of alcohol and drugs to be relocated to reservations, but did not offer any support to overcome the substance use and abuse issues. So what could that do? Nothing. Okay, but that's, she said, that's the second generation that happened in Australia. The third generation removed from the actual men who were killed and imprisoned or enslaved in some way, okay? The third generation, she said, the intergenerational effects of violence manifested in the increased physical and emotional spousal abuse and other forms of domestic violence. Families were also disrupted when at-risk children were taken from their mothers and placed with non-Indigenous families. She said, that's what happened in the third generation. The fourth generation, okay, a little bit further removed, but still fourth generation. She says the original trauma begins to be reenacted against spouses and children, thus setting the norm of culturally accepted violent behavior. And then she states that in the fifth generation, the cycle of violence is repeated and compounded as unresolved trauma fueled not only more violence, but also is replicated through the severity and social distress. So how do you heal intergenerational trauma when so many generations are acting out, even though they were not the first generation, even though they were not the ones who were tortured or raped or killed or imprisoned or enslaved in some way? You have to go back to the source. And in today's topic, the doctrine of discovery is the source. I mean, how many more studies do we need? How many more generations have to bear the wounds of an institution being unwilling to rescind? The last thing we need is another superficial apology, because apologies don't do anything unless real change is behind it. And if anything is going to, you know, change, then there has to be responsibility taken for it, as well as making amends. But again, you cannot violate international law by making the abusers dictate the rules of how, you know, the vulnerable people or the oppressed people or those who have suffered, they cannot dictate how, you know, they're going to recover from this. Okay. So again, you know, what Marita Blanco did in just studying the generations and how each generation is affected, the more and more they are removed, you know, because, you know, the effects of intergenerational trauma are being handed down, not just in terms of, you know, the DNA, you know, and how trauma changes actually the protein of the genes and so forth, but also behaviorally. Okay. And so again, you know, we often say, well, something needs to change. Something needs to change. We need to do more of this. We need to do more of that. Let's throw money at it. Let's hope something happens. Well, how about we go back to the original source of the trauma? How about we fully understand what intergenerational is all about and the widespread effects, globalization and so forth, the globalized effects of intergenerational trauma? Again, I don't think anybody, you know, born when the first generation was abused and so forth, and as well as, you know, those who are living today and those who have yet to be born, we're all affected by it. We are all affected by it, and we throw up our hands and we say there shouldn't be all these mass shootings, there shouldn't be this, and we need more police officers and so forth. And, you know, and it's just, it's one Band-Aid after another after another. And to be quite honest, folks, it's, we don't need more laws. We need to enforce the laws that we have, because, you know, just to say, well, they're a nation of laws, it's like, if people aren't respecting the law, what's the point of adding more laws? So, you know, to really heal intergenerational trauma, we have to go back to the source and we have to make things right. And we have to realize the impact of it for everybody involved, directly and indirectly. Okay. And I've discovered that children and adolescents in therapy often describe their parents or grandparents who are stuck in their trauma. They often describe them as they're damaged or they're preoccupied and emotionally unavailable or emotionally limited. And as a result, children struggle to develop a sense of trust, a healthy self-image and social skills, and most importantly, safety in relationships. And traumatized parents also have difficulty with their sense of identity and autonomy and appropriate self-soothing mechanisms and affect regulation and maintaining a balanced perspective when life challenges arise. And it's, you know, parents often display just an inappropriate numbness and dissociative responses to just everyday stress because they have never been able to overcome what has been handed down to them. And they often blame themselves when, you know, it's a reaction. It is intergenerational and so forth. But how do you get out from under that without fully realizing the bigger picture? So there are many things that people can do, but, you know, telling one's story is first and foremost the key. And, you know, the reason for this is because trauma places a distorted template over our perceptions, you know, and trauma pretty much says to any one of us who's gone through something traumatic, like, this is all there is. This is all there is to you. This is as good as it's going to get. So you might as well get used to it. And it's all lies and distortions that come from, you know, other wounded people or a wounded society that has yet to embrace themselves as soul. And in fact, once we embrace ourselves as a soul and we finally let that sink in, we finally come to terms with that, we're going to be astonished to see the power of our soul to not only transcend trauma and transform our wounded energy, but we're also going to empower others to do the same. You know, but still, as history has taught, you know, many have feared the resiliency and power of the soul and therefore have tried to silence its cry. And, you know, through killings and murders and genocides and starvations and forced assimilations and humiliations and degradations and looking at people as savages or primitive, backward, unworthy, unlovable, and therefore disposable as those in control see fit. What is heartbreaking to me is that these atrocities have often been committed in the name of God by people who should see themselves as souls. In fact, even when killing is done in the so-called advancing the kingdom of God, the only thing that's truly advanced is this distorted view from those who will do anything to hang on to their power. And yet I have yet to meet anyone who begins a journey of self-discovery that sooner or later also has to work through personal and family traumatic experiences, as well as let's take a closer look at the stories that have been handed down to them by those also needing to come to terms with their own trauma. And in this sense, the family perspectives and interpretations of traumatic events seem to go hand in hand. In fact, sometimes trauma becomes a way in which individuals and families, even generations, have defined themselves, which, again, internally perpetuates this cycle of intergenerational trauma. Because if grandparents or parents or great-grandparents or other caregivers do not have a healthy sense of themselves, well, you know, they just might be struggling with intergenerational trauma, and they will unconsciously pass their issues on to younger generations in terms of their fears, their anxieties, their insecurities, and abandonment, just to name a few. Okay? but healing from intergenerational trauma can be achieved. It can be achieved. Okay. Transformational healing is something that is possible. Okay. It's given people an opportunity to, you know, just look at relationships, to understand the past, as well as what we are doing today and what we do today. Are we just perpetuating the past without having learned from it? Or are we taking into consideration what exactly are we passing on to the future? I'm Dr. James Houck, and you have been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Thank you for spending this time with me this afternoon. In the meantime, I just invite you to join me next Friday when we take a look at, we're going to go a little bit deeper now with the intergenerational trauma by understanding just how, you know, widely affects the psychological, social, spiritual, and physiological needs that we have. So until then, be careful, be safe, and may God bless. Bye-bye.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander on over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Friday at noon Pacific time on PBS Radio TV.